It's Wednesday, July 24th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel spoke before a joint session of Congress today. He had a special message for protesters.
Well, I have a message for these protesters. When the tyrants of Tehran, who hang gays from cranes and murder women for not covering their hair, are praising, promoting, and funding you, you have officially become Iran's useful idiots.
In the audience, Rashida Tlaib, who is Congress's only Palestinian-American, held up a placard that read, "War Criminal." Netanyahu was perhaps dragging a little, because the night before, protesters, having discovered he was staying at the Watergate Hotel, pulled fire alarms and, this is particularly disgusting, unleashed hundreds of maggots and crickets and worms into the hotel. There's video online of maggots crawling over a table as an Israeli and American flag stand in the background. I don't know if it's authentic video. It seems a little on the nose. It seems further unusual that there'd be some sort of meeting room with water bottles all set up that would be unguarded, allowing infiltration by protesters or poisoners. But BBC Verify confirms that the Watergate itself acknowledged the unfortunate incident of forced infestation. I'm more puzzled than anything by the special and unique place that Netanyahu has in the hearts of American protesters, specifically Americans who stand on the side of the oppressed, who are against war criminals, and this was on the other side of Rashida Tlaib's placard. Obviously, the war in Gaza has a very, very high death toll, and 10 and possibly tens of thousands of civilians are included in that death toll. But this pales in comparison to other world leaders who have visited or routinely visit the United States. In December 2022, the administration convened the United States Africa Leaders Summit, and there was Ethiopian leader Abiy Ahmed, who won the Nobel Prize, but this was before he was responsible for the war in Tigray, which killed 500,000 people, including over 50,000 civilians. This was the first summit of African leaders since 2014, which was attended by Equatorial Guinea's President Teodoro Obiang as recently as 4 months ago. Obiang was described as, quote, the world's worst dictator by The Intercept, and I just quote The Intercept's headline because they are an extremely fierce, bordering on obsessive critic of Netanyahu and Israel. Each year, the United Nations host world leaders, including the leaders of Iran, Turkmenistan, Venezuela, and the oppression there and death tolls that are directed by those leaders over the years far surpass that of the war in Gaza. Just take Basolma Bazi. He is not president or prime minister of Burkina Faso. He is just that country's viciously anti-homosexual minister of state.
We need to reconquer our own culture and take ownership. And that's why today people try to make us believe that our values and our attitudes are not natural and are not part of freedom, and that there will never be a question of homosexuality for us. Let me repeat that. Homosexuality will not take root in our countries.
None of these leaders were protested much, certainly not faced with crickets, maggots, fire alarms, hundreds, thousands in the street, any kind of public disclosure of their hotels. Is Netanyahu the worst dictator? He's not. He was popularly elected. It was a totally fair elected, unlike all but one of the individuals who I listed. Does he have the most blood on his hands? Quantifiably, no, not by a factor of at least 10, but he's certainly the most hated. And not just because he's the only one funded by the United States. Many of these men are. He's certainly the one that most Americans have heard of. And I sometimes do wonder if the source of the hatred against him is based only on his misdeeds or his country's standing, or maybe, and this is what monitors of anti-Semitism claim, maybe ethnic animus, to view the leader of Israel in much, much worse light than other leaders who have done much, much worse things. Worms and maggots were released. It doesn't take a deep scholar of anti-Semitism to see anti-Semitism at work there. Netanyahu is to some degree, and this might seem like a weird word, but it's apt, he's the most exciting man for Americans to hate. This is especially true if you are the kind of activist who sees a clear connection between stopping a war and advocating for victims and releasing maggots into hotel rooms. On the show today, well, yesterday, President Trump said he would debate Kamala Harris. He has agreed to a couple of debates twice with Joe Biden. He'll stick to that, he said, though he complained about ABC as the hosts of the debate. The debate between him and Biden was unusually consequential. Often the best we can hope for from a debate is pace, relevance, and clarity. One masterful moderator of debates, and also an excellent interviewer in his own right, is Kyle Clark. He recently conducted a few debates in his home state of Colorado in his position as anchor and debate moderator for 9 News, the NBC affiliate there. In a whole show interview, we will talk with Kyle Clark, who went viral to some extent, who's just very good at his job, about the ins and outs, about being a tough question asker and an excellent debate moderator, someone who doesn't let stupid answers slide. Kyle Clark up next.
So this is a Republican primary debate. We are going to focus largely on issues of importance to Republican primary voters and on where you differ.
Kyle Clark anchors 9 News at 9 at 10 in Denver, is the anchor and managing editor of Next with Kyle Clark, airing weeknights at 6. Given his schedule, it is almost impossible, but we've booked the man. Maybe you know of Kyle Clark because he recently went viral for an excellent job moderating a debate between Republicans running for U.S. House Colorado District 4. I want to talk about moderating that debate. Lauren Boebert was there. I want to talk about his excellent one-on-one interviews with different political figures and his philosophy of interviewing in media. Kyle, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks for the invite, Mike.
So I think many of us saw, maybe even on Jimmy Kimmel, you getting kudos for the job you did. And I echo that. You did an excellent job. But you know, and I know, that it wasn't just the hour there during the debate where you shone. There was so much that went into those moments. And I would point out that you put an invite out for lengthy interviews with all the candidates. A couple declined, but you interviewed every single candidate in that race who didn't decline, including Peter Yu, who got 6,000 votes. And I think coming in, I don't know if they, well, you tell me, do you think they had a respect for you, or they knew that they couldn't just brush you off as many political figures do now with media they don't like?
I think that they know that we try to cover politics in Colorado fairly and that we have a large interested audience that expects them to appear and answer questions.
So when you compare it to the national debate, there is only so much moderators can do given the rules that are decided upon by the candidate. Does that sort of dickering over the rules and negotiation go on with a debate like the one you moderated?
We have run our debates at 9 News in Denver the same way for years, in the sense that we expect candidates to participate. They participate without precondition, and they get the same types of questions every time. They're going to get direct, challenging questions, and we expect them to make an attempt to answer the question, and we'll make it clear when they don't answer. And we take that style regardless of party, regardless of race, whether it's a race for governor or whether it's the Denver mayor. We hold debates. In the Denver mayor's race, there are almost 20 people running this enormous field with no public polling. So we had a 13-person debate. It was a wild two-hour affair, but it was actually pretty orderly because we went in and we asked really detailed questions based on their own policies and positions, as opposed to just open-ended town hall style or the kind of free-for-all that you see sometimes in the national debates where people just lie and obfuscate at will.
Would you say the candidates need you more than you need them?
I don't know. I think they need our audience, right? They need voters. They need ways to reach a large number of people. And we have a bunch of people in Colorado that are interested in politics and policy, and they watch Next and they watch 9 News. So I think that there's an expectation that folks will come in and take challenging questions because they know those challenging questions await everybody, regardless of their politics.
Right. So Next is the most watched newscast in the MSA, and it's very important channel for people to watch. And this is going, it's well known in Colorado politics and Denver politics specifically. You have to go through there to reach voters. And those that don't, and there are, have been candidates that have skirted an interview with you, they don't usually do well. I think it's a lot different, but I'm going to ask your opinion. I think it's a lot different on the national stage. And I would say that the position of your channel in Colorado is much more powerful and much more prominent than any one channel in the national setting. Would you agree with that?
I would tend to agree with that. I think that local journalism these days is uniquely powerful because it's uniquely connected to communities, and it is uniquely accountable in a way that the national media is not necessarily accountable to viewers. There are neighbors, right? We're accessible to them. And as a result, I think we've been able to just kind of stay better woven into the community, perhaps, than national media has. And with that comes great responsibility to do accountability journalism and to not abdicate that responsibility to the national media.
As a viewer, as a citizen, as a press critic, and also as a practitioner, when you watch the last presidential debate, and it was criticized for Jake Tapper and Dana Bash not fact-checking extensively, but did you, knowing what you know, say, well, it's not that easy, the rules didn't allow it, the format didn't allow it, or did you say, you know, they could have gotten in there and held either of the candidates to account a little more? Because you do that.
They can only operate within the rules by which they're constrained. I do think you run into trouble when you tell the candidates ahead of time that they will not be fact-checked in real time, because that is an invitation for them to lie, or at least to flood the zone with so many lies that their opponent cannot fact-check them in any kind of reasonable way. I think the thing that we have to wrestle with, and right, if this was easy, we would have all figured it out and journalists would do debates the same way. The thing we need to figure out is, if journalists are not going to be able to perform acts of journalism during debates, then do we need journalists moderating debates? Could mm-hmm. we have AI and a timer?
Right, right. But then I think it was Ted Koppel who said, but then you're not doing journalism, you're doing technology. Just turning the cameras on and saying go. I mean, there were no cameras, but that's sort of what Lincoln and Douglas did. There was no moderator.
Yeah, and that's another way to do a debate, right? The two men walk out, or a man and woman walk out, sit down at a table, and they just go at it for 2 hours. I think where we run into trouble is when we have journalists in the room who are capable of doing real-time fact-checking, but we don't allow them to do it.
Will you fact-check every substantial fact that is misstated by a candidate?
No, only if it's absolutely central and material to what we're talking about. I mean, take a comment made by Jerry Sonnenberg, who was a candidate for Congress in that debate that included Lauren Boebert on our air. We were talking about immigration policy, and he made a comment about, you know, migrants driving up crime in Denver, to which I just asked, what evidence do you have of that? And he acknowledged that he has none. And it was a hunch of his. That's the kind of thing that we'll check. We're not going to nitpick for every little thing.
Right. What about the Gish Gallop? That's a debating term, or just the style. I'll just say it. Donald Trump often uses it. So many misstatements, and many of them in substance in a row, but making it impossible, really. But you tell me if it is possible to go and try to unravel all of them.
I think as a moderator.
I mean, have you had that? Let me interrupt. Have you had that? Do you have any candidates, I'm going to use it in quotes, as skilled as to be able to achieve that effect?
No, I don't think that I've run into one. There are certainly people who will string together one falsehood or another. Or what we saw in a lot of debates were candidates basically inventing their own reality and then answering a question based on that reality. So when we ask questions in our debates, we try to lay out the predicate with enough factual information that a casual follower of politics who doesn't live and breathe this stuff knows from the question what we're talking about and what's going on. But then it forces the candidate to live within that reality. They can't create a fantasy world from which to operate in their answer.
Other than very good questions to Lauren Boebert and allowing Lauren Boebert to answer some of her opponents, there were other moments that didn't even have anything to do with Boebert, and I thought they showed excellent craftsmanship. You asked Mike Lynch, the State House Minority Leader, a question that I think 9 out of 10 debate moderators would have said something like, you were arrested for drunk driving, what do you say to the people of your district? But you asked, why did you keep it from your caucus?
Mr. Lynch,
yes.
You resigned your position as House Minority Leader after your drunk driving arrest surfaced this year. And my question is not about what you did while drunk, which for anybody who missed it was speeding up I-25 at 90 miles per hour so fast a trooper thought that you were trying to race him. Then you reached for your gun during the traffic stop. You asked the trooper to call the State Patrol's lobbyist. Then you asked him to keep the arrest out of the media. My question to you is about what you did while sober. You did not disclose your drunk driving arrest to your Republican colleagues when they were considering you for leader and electing you.
No.
What does that tell voters about your judgment?
Well, thank you, Kyle, for that.
Tell me about the construction of that question and why you thought that was the better question.
Well, I just think anytime you're asking somebody a question about what they've done while under the influence, they're always going to be able to point to the fact that they were under the influence and that colored their decision making and that they will try to make better decisions or they're now sober or whatever else. I wanted to ask him a question about what he did while he was stone cold sober, which is that he didn't tell his colleagues about this thing that had just happened. And I take him at his word that alcohol is no longer a part of his life, and that's fantastic for him. But let's talk about your sober decision making that will be what you do going forward.
Yeah, so part of that question is knowing how he's answered it in the past, anticipating he will say, well, blame it on the drunkenness and say I am no longer drunk, and then taking it, and I'll point this out, to an area where the Colorado Republican primary voters would be very sensitive. You really didn't take into account Colorado Republicans in this case. So that was, I'm going to use the word clever, but that was a well-constructed question.
Well, it was a GOP primary debate. Our audience was people who would be voting in a GOP primary debate. So we tried to tailor all of our questions to things that would matter to Colorado Republicans or to unaffiliateds who would vote in that GOP primary, whether we were talking about Donald Trump or whether we were talking about Mike Lynch's DUI or whether we were talking about earmarks. We were looking for daylight between Republicans and conservatives on those issues to explore those differences.
You have apologized for the theater incident.
I certainly have.
And I just want to make sure. Did you apologize for the behavior that went on with you and your date or the vaping, or did you apologize for lying to voters about what you did that night and the disrespect that you showed to service workers that night? What specifically were you apologizing for?
I don't believe there was disrespect. There were things.
You asked Lauren Boebert who exactly she was apologizing to. Was this something in the air? Was this something that when many people read the apology, they themselves were saying this is an unclear apology, or did you pick up on it, do you think?
That was a question that I had always had, and I had talked about on the air, because she has very much tried to make this that the media was out to get her because of her romantic behavior with her date. And we have made very clear through our reporting that was not our area of interest. It was whether she lied about what happened at the theater in excusing her behavior, or what would have been an even bigger story if the Denver Center for the Performing Arts had lied about a sitting member of Congress. So one way or another, there was a big story there. Either a member of Congress was lying about her behavior, that she was not vaping, that she was not disruptive in the theater. Again, this had nothing to do with the romantic stuff with her date. Or a publicly funded taxpayer agency was lying about a member of Congress. And that's the reason why we went to them and we said, you have security video. And they have security video. And apparently it's very clear. And he took a look at it. And sure enough, she wasn't telling the truth. So then when she apologized, my question was, to whom are you apologizing? Was it the service workers that you clearly disrespected on your way out the door? The pregnant woman you were vaping in the face of? Are you apologizing for the lying to voters? Or are you apologizing for the mutual grope session, which honestly is at the absolute bottom of my concerns?
Yeah. And she chose E, none of the above. I'm apologizing for you, Kyle Clark. Mike Lynch also tried to turn it around on you. Sometimes this works. I haven't seen it in a debate that you've moderated, but sometimes by works, I would say that the audience agrees with the person making that argument. I did not perceive in those cases it to work for the candidates. What do you think makes turning it around on the media work, and when doesn't it work?
I think it works when it causes the journalist to recalibrate their behavior. And
so it's how you react, like what flits across your face in the moment?
Yeah, or whether you can rattle a journalist or convince a media outlet to stop asking critical questions, right? It's just working the ref, right? That's what, yep. When you turn around, they're just working the ref. And when you make it clear that they're not going to be able to work the ref, they're not going to be able to shake you by turning something around, then often they'll stop.
There is a type of question that you ask, which is really just an expression of indignation. And I would say you didn't exactly do that with Boebert, though it can be read there. But here I'll direct you to an interview that you did. As I said, you interviewed all those candidates beforehand. And one was a long interview with Richard Holthorff.
Be a cut above. I've even said this to my own girls. I've said your behavior has to be a cut above everybody else, particularly when people are looking at you.
And he has, and this also came up in the debate, criticized Lauren Boebert's manner of dress. And you asked quite pointedly, why is that any of your damn business?
At the highest level possible. And I think that matters. I think that matters.
Any of your damn business.
Because that person...
Tell me about the calibration of asking the question that way.
Well, that was a follow-up to my original question where I listed off all kinds of different ways that he shows disrespect to people, whether it is by race, by gender, insensitivity to people with disabilities, people who have lost folks through tragedy. My question to him was simply, why do you talk to people that way? Like, this is a man whose disrespect appears to know no bounds. And then he defended it by basically saying, well, I have daughters, so I can tell women how to dress. Mm-hmm. And that just stunned me. And I'm thinking, here's a sitting congresswoman feet away from you, and you're lecturing her on how she should dress. So at that moment, I just said what occurred to me, which was essentially like, why is it any of your damn business how this woman dresses?
Do you think debates are the best or even a very valuable MRI into a politician's soul, governing style, or whatever else should properly form a voter's opinion?
I mean, this is self-serving, right? Because I conduct debates, but I think that they're highly useful for voters. I really do, because there are so many scripted settings in which you can hear politicians and candidates say what they want to say, get asked friendly questions or open-ended questions, never really get challenged. Or if they do, they get challenged in the same rote ways that they always get challenged. But if we're asking people to represent us and serve in challenging jobs in which they are going to face crises large and small, and they're going to have to think on their feet, let's put them through a little test where they have to think on their feet in front of us. Why would we not? It feels like it's a pretty good corollary to what they're going to do on the job.
It does also strike me that the best way for a candidate to appear good in a debate is to essentially do what you do so well, to give as well as you give, to take as well as you take, to meet your verbal dexterity with arguments in fully digestible paragraphs. My question is, and as I already said, I don't know how much that comports with governing, but in your experience, are there candidates, are there politicians who don't seem to have given the best answer, but sometimes the voters just like them somehow?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I would say former Colorado governor, now Senator John Hickenlooper.
I think you're right. So what are the commonalities of those kind of performers? What would they have in common that they're not great at debates, but people still, they're not seen as great communicators, but the people they're trying to communicate with feel well communicated to?
I think they read as genuine. I think they read as true believers, that they believe what they're saying, even if they can't perfectly articulate it. I think voters are also willing to give a lot of credit to somebody that they feel is genuine and earnest, right? We're not electing a speech and debate champion. Hopefully what people are gleaning from the debate is insight into their character. How do they react when challenged? When they're presented with a difficult issue, do they skirt around it or do they make a good faith effort to tackle the tough stuff? I think that matters a ton.
Do you think you would like for this to be true? And you ask hard questions to people of all parties and people within a race, all the candidates for a seat. But do you think you actually get credit among the other candidates, say a Republican candidate, you get credit from them because you also ask hard questions to Democratic Governor Jared Polis, let's say?
Yeah, that's the reason why they walk out of the debate. And generally the reaction is whew, that was something, but you were fair. Right. You know, it's always the first person to get lit up on the debate stage that's indignant about it because they forget that, you know, the bell's going to toll for everybody. Right. And it's, you know, it's coming around for everybody. And I think it's very, very rare for somebody to walk out of our debates or for campaign staff to reach out later and say that they think that something was unfair or out of context. No, we take the same approach with everybody. You're going to come in, you're going to get challenged. People deserve to see how you respond.
running against the media works nationally, and it works in some places. Are you saying it doesn't work with you in Colorado, in Denver, or it hasn't worked so far for whatever reason?
The gubernatorial candidate on the Republican side last time around in Colorado ran on an anti-media campaign, and specifically a fixation on our program and our reporting. She was the only candidate, Democrat, Republican, unaffiliated, who has refused to debate on 9 News in recent years. And she essentially ran an anti-media campaign, and she took an L by nearly 20 points. Yeah. So now, is that because she ran an anti-media campaign? I can't say that, but I know that she made that the focal point of her campaign, and it was a drubbing.
Is Lauren Boebert not running an anti-media campaign?
I think that that's part of her shtick. But again, remember, she loves media because she loves attention. She just doesn't love media that will challenge her.
Right. But that is true. And for many years, it's like if you love attention, you have to go through the News 9s and the CNNs. And now it's not. Now there's a whole ecosystem where you could bypass that. But you're saying Boebert hasn't fully embraced that.
I don't think so. I will say she is very cautious about going near anybody who is going to ask her a real question.
Yeah.
And she has been for years. That's not a new development.
We're going to take a quick pause and then be right back with more Kyle Clark. We're back with Kyle Clark, who I wanted to ask about his long-form interviews. When you construct a question, are you looking to ask the hardest version of the question for the candidate to answer? That would show something. Or are you looking to ask the fairest version of the question?
That's an interesting way to put it. I'm looking to ask what I think is going to elicit the most honest response, right? Because it's not about my question. It's about their response. I will say that's one thing that kind of bothers me about some of the attention on our recent debates is that I've seen some spliced togethers that are just like our questions and not their responses. And debates are not about our questions. Debates are about their responses. Hopefully we're asking questions in an interesting, challenging way that elicits a great response. But when I'm asking Richard Holtorf,
you have talked openly about various women that you have been pregnant and one who had an abortion. And you said on the floor of the House, quote, "I respected her rights and actually gave her money to help her through her important critical time so she could live her best life." In the legislature, you have voted to limit abortion access for other women, but you say that you respected your girlfriend's right to an abortion so that she could live her best life. If abortion was the best choice for your girlfriend, why try to deny that choice to other women?
So let me give you some context about that situation.
I asked eight versions of that question.
Yes, you did.
To other women. And I'm asking, why is an abortion good for your girlfriend, bad for other women? Why do you seek to deny it to other women?
Let me, I don't.
Why was it okay when you were the father?
It wasn't okay. It wasn't okay.
Do you regret saying,
I was in California.
Do you regret saying that you respected her rights?
I don't have any regrets.
Okay, do you regret saying that it was so that she could live her best life?
Can I please
Do you regret saying that?
Can I please finish my sentence?
Do you regret saying that it was so that she could live her best life?
Can I please finish? I don't have any regrets in my life.
Okay. Access to other women. Do you see the disconnect?
I understand your point, but I don't feel the same way you do. I don't think we should be killing babies willy-nilly.
I don't know that any of them got a satisfactory answer. But what they demonstrated was this appears to be a man who has not grappled with that disconnect, that very obvious disconnect, because we went at it for 15 minutes about that glaring gulf, and he just did not appear to recognize it at all.
A couple years ago, you also interviewed a candidate for governor who lost in the Republican primary to the candidate you were talking about who ran against the media. I'm talking about Greg Lopez. And Greg Lopez was arrested in 1993 for domestic assault. His wife was pregnant at the time, and Lopez also is anti-abortion in all cases. So you ask the question as, do you see these two things at odds in that they both involve your asserting control over a woman's body? I would say being anti-abortion is certainly a legitimate enough stance that many people take and many people will respond to. It's a very tough situation and one he brought on himself to try to answer for a domestic assault. But was that question constructed in the fairest way possible or the one that would make him squirm the most? Because there is a benefit. I could see a benefit if he were able to answer the question well. He was not. At the same time, I think that it was constructed to put him on the spot.
I think that that's a fair assessment of the question in the sense that it's always fair, right, for a candidate to say, I reject the premise of your question.
Yeah.
Always fair, right? And I can certainly see Greg Lopez or somebody else who shares his anti-abortion views saying, I don't see restricting abortion as control over a woman's body, right? And that's a fair perspective for him to offer if he wants to offer that. I'll tell you why I constructed that question that way. That DV arrest of his is not new. That's been circulating for a long time. He's been asked about that a lot of times and a lot of different ways. What I was attempting to do is to say, hey, some people might see a commonality between you striking your pregnant wife and your desire to control the bodies of pregnant women. To which he could have replied, and I think he did, if I recall, like, I don't see it that way. I don't see that connection. I believe that he essentially asserted that one, that he doesn't view restrictions on abortion as control over a woman's body. And he also attempted to explain away the domestic violence incident by saying, well, I mean, we were both arrested that night.
Yes.
To which I said, yes, and one of you was pregnant, right? I mean, yes, I understand that people get in fights all the time, but society generally says that when people are trading blows and one of them is pregnant, the person who is not pregnant may have a higher duty to say, let's hold off. So that's what I was trying to get at.
That is a good answer. I put myself in his position, not that I have that stance or ever abused a woman, but he could have also said, you know, my wife is exactly where I am on abortion. We're still married and she is not trying to have any control or exerting or giving up control over her body. That's maybe if he had thought about the question or anticipated it. Maybe you asking the question in that way was new to him, right? Maybe he knows he has to answer for this domestic violence thing. He has a certain thing he has to say, and he knows what his stance is on abortion. But he never really thought of it as controlling a woman's body being the through line.
And it would have been completely fair for him to respond. And I think he did in a way to just kind of say, I don't see the connection between those two things.
Yeah.
And you know what? Then that's fair. And then voters get to look at that and say, I agree with that guy. There's no connection between those things. Or I think that there might be a connection and I'm not comfortable with where he stands.
Yeah. And there's a value to the exercise overall, however
yes.
he answered. And also, let's also note the fact that he sat for the interview and his opponent didn't, although it didn't seem to hurt her in the Republican primary. Are there any trends in putting you on the spot type questions going on now that bother you? Because I'm going to throw this one out there. There is a current, we all know that there was election denialism and this was a big problem. And there are court cases. In fact, I think I read that Colorado. What is the state of Colorado and supposed concocted electors? Did they bring cases against any?
No, we did not have a fake slate of electors, but Colorado was the birthplace of a lot of the conspiracy theories about right. the election. Dominion Voting Systems is based in Denver.
Right.
Tina Peters, the Republican clerk who surreptitiously got into the voting systems to copy data and give it to conspiracy theorists, that came out of Colorado. So those have kind of been our ties.
Right. So there is a trend in asking, I think, an impossible to answer question. It will cause squirming, but will it really lead light? And that is to ask, especially a Republican, do you swear to stand by the results of the election? Since the future is unknowable, it assumes that the election will be fair. And then if the Republican, especially the Republican, points this out, it makes it seem like they're denying the last election. So that is a pet peeve of mine. And I don't think that's the fairest question. I've seen you ask versions of that question. So I could violate a good question asker's creed by asking a two-part question. Are there types of questions that are popular that annoy you? And tell me about the best way to get at an answer like standing by results of the election when they are on the up and up.
I agree with you in the sense that asking people to agree to a hypothetical scenario that has not yet happened is not a great way to ask that question. The great news is we just had a free and fair election that people dispute the results from, that there's lots of evidence and study on. So ask the question in a backward looking way. I know that's not always our tendency, but like, you know, ask them about 2020 and ask them, was that a free and fair election? Do you accept those results? If not, why not? And then that tells you everything that you need to know for 2024. But asking people, will they accept an election result in which they think that there might be some malfeasance going on, asking them to preemptively accept it. Yeah, I don't love that. I don't love that question. Ask them about what just happened that has been studied extensively and see if they're in tune with reality there.
Here's my last question. Should we be bringing this kind of scrutiny to other walks of life? I would love to see a Kyle Clark type sit down with the general manager of the Broncos. Who's that? George Patton, Peyton, and just grill him on what is your quarterback situation looking like? Would we benefit from that, or would that ruin sports and drag it down to where politics is?
Do organizations benefit from scrutiny? Yes, they do. That is the answer. Yes. Would sports organizations be benefited by having more critical coverage as opposed to reams of in-house reporters who are on the same payroll as the people that they cover? Yes. I think that would be beneficial. I'll be honest with you, though, as much trouble as the Broncos have, we need to start with the Rockies.
I know. And how about the Avalanche? Things aren't great in the Denver sports scene right now.
Listen. I think the Nuggets are close. They're still in the window. Yes. The Avs are still in the window. The Broncos are trying to figure out the difference between an exit door and a window. But the Rockies, I'm telling you, that's the accountability interview that I want about what are the plans other than just selling people beer with a great view, because it is a great place to watch a ball game.
Kyle Clark is the anchor and managing editor of Next with Kyle Clark, and he anchors the new 9 NBC Denver 9 and 10 p.m. broadcast, and somehow he carved out a few minutes with us here on The Gist. Thanks so much, Kyle.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Leo Baum is the real deal and a real tour, as well as our intern. Michelle Pesca is in charge of potato salad procurement for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn Ads, which I found out quite recently is what AdvertiseCast has been rebranded. Be so advised. Wait, Mike, does this mean to advertise on The Gist, you should go to advertisecast.com/The Gist. Yeah, you can still go there. That still works. It's a very useful website. Oompru-gee-pru-doo-pru, and thanks for listening.